is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Welcome to another Viewpoint This Sunday. This is Malcolm Out Loud.
So mentally, I'm all set for Bernie. Communist, I had everything down. He's a communist. I was all set. And then we have this crazy thing that happened, right? On Tuesday, which he thought was Thursday. But he also said 150 million people were killed with guns, and he was running for the United States Senate. Support me, I'm running for the United States. There's something going on there. But I was all set. I was all set. And, you know, when I focus, and we all focus, sometimes you do well and some people choke. I watched Minnie Mike choke when Minnie Mike was hit by a very mean woman. He said, get me off this stage, just get me off. And that wasn't a pretty sight to be with. But I was all set to take on Bernie. So now I'm ready for Bernie, and now all of a sudden I have a whole different, you know, it's a whole different deal, two very different people. I think in a certain way Bernie would be tougher because he's got a base. Say, you know, I don't think I'm running against Bernie. I think it's going to be very hard for him to come back.
Well, you hear the audio there of President Trump. Now, that was the town hall that I'm sure many of you listened to. It was, in fact, I know a lot of you listened to it. It was the most listened to town hall in the history of cable television. That is something. Well, let's bring on next to your friends, Michael Johns joins us here at the Top Stories. Michael is the national co-founder and leader of the Tea Party movement. He's a former White House speechwriter and a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. And Michael is a great voice out there nationally. We'd love to get his opinion on these things. Michael, let's start and talk about some politics here. This is a great place to start, which is the general election here in 2020. But let's talk about the president in that town hall. And you hear the audio setup on that here. He was quite interesting and very entertaining when you look at him, and then you position that with some of these other candidates. The president looked at ease, did he not?
Oh, he looks incredibly at ease, and he's entertaining and, you know, a great communicator in his own way. I think what really, I've never heard anyone really put it this way, but the thing that I noticed in the Scranton town hall that I think I've noticed before, but never quite put it together this way, is that he presents his inner thoughts out loud, presents them out loud. And I think people that are listening, people that are a part of it, feel a part of his, feel closer to him as a result of it. They feel a connection. He'll go through what his thought process was. Sometimes he'll even, you know, ask an audience, what do you think, this or that? I can remember on, should we be doing Make America Great Again or Keep America Great? You know, getting audience response, asking an audience, what candidate would be better for me to face, Biden or Sanders? And I think the audience easily puts themselves in the shoes of the president, which is not easy to do, and can sympathize with sort of the thought process and decision making that he's going through and the challenges he's going through. And so it's a new way of communication, I think, for a president of the United States, something that certainly would never have worked for the president that I worked for or any other president of our lifetime who laid things out very formally. I mean, obviously they try to get the audience engaged, but not at this level where it's like a thinking out loud, almost communicative style. I really like it. I think it's very creative and constructive, and it's working.
And he's changed the script entirely in how a president acts. Now, what you say there is very important, because the way he puts it, in my business, we call that authenticity. And you see, people always relate. Americans always relate to authenticity in a big way. But you know what, Michael? We've never seen that, as you say, from a politician, period, but certainly from a president, never. But that's also what gets him into trouble because his critics don't know how to handle that openness. In fact, that just happened when he was speaking the other day here about the ship on the coronavirus out off in the waters here that was out in San Francisco. And he said, well, yeah, you know, I'd like to keep him on the ship if I could, because, you know, it keeps the numbers real low. Now, that's the way, you know, that's an honest reaction. Now, of course, he was really lambasted for that because he's being honest again. But the point is, what you're saying is really important. But that's also the attraction as to why people like him a lot and why he resonates. And that's why that town hall was wildly successful. You never know what Trump's going to say. In fact, you remember the saying early on when he became president, Michael, let Trump be Trump, right?
Right.
That was it, right? I mean, let Trump be Trump. And that's what that really means, is he's an authentic kind of guy. He's going to put it out there. Now, what I really found interesting about the town hall was how the humor he had. I mean, the establishment obviously is rallying around Biden. Is he the one that takes this? Has he become the candidate? Do you think Bernie has?
I think anyone who says they know for sure is guessing. But look, it's, I think, 664 to 573 now. The other candidates are not dividing in any way that's going to be meaningful for either one of them. They're going to split pretty evenly as far as a delicate allegation. And then if you look at the coming primaries, you know, Idaho, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, Washington, number of southern states there where you think, again, Biden's going to fare well. But I'm intrigued by, I think, this March 15th debate, which is going to be the first one-on-one debate between Biden and Sanders. That could really be a defining moment. Beware the Ides of March, Shakespeare said. So I think we might face a little bit of that on March 15th and seeing, you know, for instance, is Sanders going to bring up Burisma? Is he going to bring up Biden's support for the Iraq war? Is he going to bring up Biden's previous proposal to cut Social Security? How aggressive is Biden going to be in going after Sanders's embrace of socialism and pinning him down, getting him to renounce some of these socialist dictatorships? Also, to be honest with you, Sanders's lack of legislative accomplishment, which is something I've emphasized a lot. I mean, when you look at this guy's 30 to 40 years, there's a lot you can give him credit for in rhetoric and in, you know, moving the party to the left, even breaking with his party for a point.
Yeah.
But what legislatively has he accomplished? I mean, he's renamed a few post offices and a few other minor pieces of legislation. It's really not a career of immense legislative accomplishment. And
no,
if I were on the Biden side, I'd be bringing that up.
Let's face it. This is Bernie Sanders' last hurrah. So how much will Bernie Sanders pull out? You know, in a very unique way, he could really help the conservative movement out, as you know, and certainly help Donald Trump be reelected by raising these things, like Burisma, like you say, with Hunter Biden. Those are real issues that could absolutely be raised. So we're in a very unique place because Bernie Sanders could help actually without not, he doesn't want to, obviously, but help Trump in many interesting ways as he goes ahead on the offensive and attack Joe Biden. Now, who do you think Elizabeth Warren will get behind at the end of the day? Does she stay with Bernie? Because she's really mad with Bernie right now. She's not happy with Bernie Sanders, you know?
Yeah, obviously they had that little squabble over what did or didn't happen as far as the electability of
who was lying and who wasn't lying.
Female candidate. Who knows what if that did or didn't happen. It seems to be Sanders. Warren has a very suspicious background, at least as it relates to truth-telling. But let's assume we don't know. I think that personal rift, like if I were in the Elizabeth Warren camp, which is very difficult for me to put myself in that position, but just to think about it, there really shouldn't be a whole lot of thought involved in this. Ideologically, the logical alignment is with Bernie Sanders. And, you know, if she's going to be true to this progressive agenda, which has been really the motivating factor behind her wanting to run, at least her stated reason for wanting to run, you would think that logically is where that would fall. It seems very difficult to envision her abandoning, you know, the Medicare for All plan, which Biden doesn't support. et cetera. So I think now her holding out is probably one of trying to see what she can actually negotiate in the way of leverage. Yeah. You know, can she get some sort of commitment?
You know, the other thing is that she came out, had an interview with Rachel Maddow, and she says she went after his, did you see that, obviously, his supporters. She called them really ugly. She says, I think it's, I think it's a real problem with this online bullying and sort of organized nastiness. And I'm not just talking about saying mean things. She says, I'm talking about some really ugly stuff that went on. But that's kind of what they did to the Trump supporters as well when Trump was running 20, in fact, they're still doing it. But back in 2015, they went after the supporters, and then they get the candidate to take responsibility for the supporters. That's kind of a weird way of doing things. But that's kind of what she's doing now with Sanders.
Yeah, it does seem to me like you got to fess up to the fact that you didn't run a great campaign. You didn't resonate with the voters. These identification of, gee, we were bullied online or there was sexism are really not going to resonate in this country. I don't, you know, let me be clear. Online bullying is a real thing. It's a particular problem with youth. But if you're going to make the decision, as she did a long time ago, as Bernie Sanders did a long time ago, as I sort of did a long time ago, to get into this arena, your skin's got to be reasonably thick. You got to be able to sort of sustain that stuff. I just think it was a poorly managed campaign on just about every front. She didn't communicate very well. She embraced these far left ideas.
When they don't run on policy and they don't have anything to come back with, then they turn to like the sexism kind of thing. And that's usually the, that's kind of a big deal for these people. I mean, you're seeing that a lot in the Democrat Party, identity politics. They run on that all the time. They never admit that, you know, my campaign stunk or my policies are not effective, or that's never admitted.
She made the decision to withdraw. The appropriate, I think, response would have been, we gave this our all. Mm-hmm. We believe in the vision that we offered for the country. We still believe in that vision. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we look at the remaining candidates, the person who most identifies with that vision is Bernie Sanders, and I'm proud to put my support behind him. That would have been the appropriate response. No excuses and no ambivalence as it relates to the remaining candidates.
No, I mean, that's right. And you're speaking back to the way politics used to be. I mean, the losers were at one point graceful and they would bow out and do exactly what you say there. But that doesn't seem the way it is anymore, and certainly not in these Democratic power struggles that are happening here. Well, listen, let's agree with this. We're about ready right now. We're going to enter one of the most entertaining political seasons we've ever seen in our lifetimes. I think you would agree with me when I say that. And it's going to be fascinating to see how Biden and Sanders go at it, who Warren supports eventually, as you say, probably Sanders. And then when you get to the big race of Trump and whoever it's going to be there, I think you're going to see an all-out battle. Listen, let's move it along here. Mike, I want to talk to you about the coronavirus next year, which I know a lot of people listen and say, oh my God, do we have to? Well, it is in the news. It's actually dominating the news. It's dominating thoughts. It's dominating everybody's feelings and the stock market and about everything, no matter what you look at.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. President Trump signs the law in that $8.3 billion bill, you know, to fight the coronavirus outbreak. And this is also to help develop a vaccine. He's been meeting with the pharmaceutical companies as well. They feel like they're already edging forward with to having some answers once it goes through the trials and all of that. But here's the thing. You got the spending bill now. They've got some resources. You've got panic going on everywhere. And we'll talk more about this in greater detail later in the program. But there's also the economic toll of this virus. First of all, in your lifetime, Michael, have you ever seen anything quite like this? Because you weren't here with the Spanish flu and that pandemic back then. So have you ever seen anything like this in your lifetime? And let's talk about the economic toll of the coronavirus. And you've seen the unstableness of the market here. What happens next, you think?
Well, we don't really know. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty about the course this is going to take. You know, this could turn out to be utterly devastating, the worst public health threat of, you know, a century, or it could stagnate. And I, you know, I hate to equivocate on that, but that just is the reality. I really don't think its course is clear cut. If you and the question of, have we seen anything like it? I would say, yeah, maybe we have. I think if you look at the SARS epidemic back in 2003, you would say there's some commonality and similarity. That was a global public health risk. I think it ended up, sickening thousands of people and took the lives of hundreds. This has strong probability, obviously, of being worse than that. So we had, say, $0.3 billion that was allocated by Congress. As you recall, I found it interesting that the Trump administration asked, I think, for $1.25 billion and to reallocate another $1.25 billion for $2.5 total. Mm-hmm. And Congress came in and applied the multiplier effect to that number, basically. And interestingly, not because they had all these great ideas on how it should be utilized, because if you look at the actual allocation, you have 3.1 of the 8.3 that's left at the discretion of the Secretary of Health and Human Services mm-hmm. for the next 4 years, and then a lot that's granted toward state departments of health to use at their discretion. So it's really just this affirmation that we think you're going to need an extraordinary amount of resources. Here you go. And, and then you ultimately are hoping you have a sufficient degree of confidence in how those funds are going to be utilized. But it certainly should be reassuring, I think, to those that are concerned about the governmental response to this, that we're taking it immensely seriously.
Don't you think Congress actually upped the ante? My take on that was they initially tried to embarrass the president. That's what they were trying to do there by saying, yeah, take more, right? I mean, come on,
Right. I mean, the line on this has been clear from day one, is to try to depict Trump as not taking this seriously not sufficiently well managing it. There's no sign of that, and to politicize it, because let's be honest, Democrats really don't have a lot to be pointing to as it relates to Trump's performance. Mm-hmm. Just about every metric on the economy, just about every item that he discussed in his 2016 campaign is being checked off. I mean, he is delivering as he promised, and under, as the American people know, some very difficult political circumstances with just about zero cooperation from Democrats.
Yeah.
So sadly, from day one, I think, as the president correctly pointed out, he couldn't do anything right in their eyes on this. And that's really unfortunate, because it's not the way to be responding to a public health crisis.
No, not at all. Not at all. But this was, don't you see this? I mean, this was clearly, they looked at this as an opportunity to take Trump down, and they're still looking at it at that, because you see what's going on in the markets, you see the fear that's playing out, and some of this is potentially legit, but a lot of it is not legit. It's being overhyped and overfear.
One thing that should be non-negotiable in this whole thing is we need to, for the purposes of containing the current crisis mm-hmm. and understanding the possibility and preventing similar outbreaks in the future, to understand the origin of this beyond any doubt.
That's right.
And that can't simply be taking, unfortunately, that cannot be taking the Chinese Communist Party at their word, because they have a long track record of misleading the world, the community, and their own people about what really did transpire. I don't know what transpired, and there's a lot of different theories out there. And then, of course, there's China's official explanation.
That's right.
But we owe it to ourselves and to the world, I think, to understand the origins of this beyond any doubt, because that really is key to future prevention.
Listen, we're going to do a deeper dive bit later in the program and talk about things you should be doing to protect yourself as well when it comes to the market and comes to things like this. And we'll also talk about the risk factor here and some of the social cultural factors of this virus thing. So a lot more ahead on that. I want to change it up now, and I want to talk to you about another news story here, Michael, and that is the Trump administration has just announced they're sending 500 ICE agents to aid the sanctuary city arrest. So this is our Immigration Customs Enforcement, and this is them ramping up. And there's basically 10 sanctuary cities they're targeting to redeploy these 500 investigators, if you will, to aid these arrests. And this, it seems to me like the sanctuary cities are starting to, this is becoming a real big point now. And here's the thing. With open borders, this is going to be a big deal in the election coming up, because the Democrats have been absolutely pushing and promoting for the last many years open borders, And now you see these viruses and these worldwide pandemics and the potential for all kinds of sicknesses coming over the border there. And now you see the really brainchild that Trump did when he ran on this, when it comes about, you know, our sovereignty and our borders itself. But I think this story about sending the ICE agents to the sanctuary city's arrest, I think there's a real battle lines being drawn right now with the sanctuary cities, because you see that story last week, Michael, where the federal appeals court ruled Trump can withhold grants from sanctuary cities. I think it's going to be a big talking point right. of the election coming up, don't you think?
I do. I mean, just first on the border issue, I think, you know, if you're a Democrat, you say you're serious about the opioid crisis, but you're not serious about a border wall, you're not serious about the opioid crisis. If you say you're serious about coronavirus, but you don't support a border wall, you're not serious about the coronavirus.
That's right.
Because the sovereignty of our country and the defense of that southern border is crucial mm-hmm. to rolling back and containing the drug and public health pandemics that we face in this country. And not recognize that shows a failure to recognize the origin of and basis of these threats. These are threats, both of them, that did not and do not originate in the United States. They would not be possible were it not for transport through international means and particularly our border crisis. So I think that raises the issue. And then as it relates to sanctuary cities, it's just logical. I think more is being made out of this than really needs to be made out of it. And we're talking about 500 agents, I believe. They're being redeployed. You said 10 cities. That's about right, I guess. So, you know, what are you talking about? 50 additional agents put in each city to accommodate for the fact that you don't have local governments, municipal governments, city governments cooperating with the federal government on an issue of enforcing our immigration laws.
Listen, another big story here that has just developed in the last day or so here, Michael, is this was really quite something, actually. We knew Congressman Mark Meadows. We knew he was going to be somehow part of the administration. We knew that. I was surprised with the timing of this myself personally, and I wonder if you were as well, because he will replace Mick Mulvaney as the chief of staff. And I wonder, is the timing brilliant, or should they have waited closer to the election? What you really don't want, I mean, you want a chief of staff, Mark Meadows, to be at his best, as President Trump takes the next 4 years on. You know, in this position, I think this is like the fourth or so. I mean, it's a very volatile spot to be in to begin with. What's your take on that?
Well, the fact that the president never gave Mulvaney the full title of chief of staff and kept the acting,
yeah.
Title associated with it was a sign that there was likely going to be a change, probably would be a change, or that it was an interim appointment, which it proved to be. There's a lot of inside the White House political views on this. I don't think that's what really matters. Ultimately, you want a chief of staff that can work hand in glove with the President of the United States in directing both the administration and in coordinating policy and political messaging in a critical moment in this administration. Now, I think the world of Mark Meadows, I thought highly of Mulvaney as well, honestly. Both of these guys came out of our Tea Party wave. Mm-hmm. As did Mike Pompeo. I mean, it's one of the great credits to the Tea Party movement is it gave birth to a good number of our current political leaders,
superstars,
some of whom are now some of whom are really now populating this administration in some of its most crucial functional roles. And I believe Mark Meadows has a fantastic public policy vision for this country. He has great political sensitivities. He's been in government now long enough that he understands the functional kind of flows of these things. And I think he has a great relationship with the president.
Does.
So
yeah,
I think
does.
It's, yeah. I think it's, I think it's a great, great appointment. And then Mulvaney staying on, I believe, handling some of the Northern Ireland issues with an ambassador rank of reassignment there. Mm-hmm. And, he'll continue to leverage his capabilities and skills as well.
Yeah.
I think the point is that the skill sets that the president needs at this moment probably are slightly different than they did one what was needed. One.
Well, that's a good point. You know, that's actually a good point. And I've got to tell you, Mark Meadows has the potential to go and down to be one of the most effective chief of staffs because of that relationship you just speak about. He is almost symbiotic in his thinking with the president, is what I gather out of that. Mark Meadows, very interesting choice.
Yeah.
And I do wonder about the timing, but
good communicator too. He himself is a good communicator.
Excellent,
you know? He and Jim Jordan. He and Jim Jordan, yeah, I think, have more than any two members of Congress, yeah, carried the president's, yeah, message and
absolutely,
and our Tea Party movement message most competently, yeah, of any of these Republicans.
The other story here I want to talk to you about is the Judge Reggie Walton of the U.S. District Court, right, for the District of Columbia. This was quite something to me, the story here. So he came out and he was really questioning the Attorney General William Barr's handling of the Mueller report. Now listen to this here. And he goes on and he says that he's going to review the entire report. And he says that he's questioning that Barr, did he create a one-sided narrative about the Mueller report, a narrative that is clearly in some respects, at odds with the redacted version of the Mueller report. And he says he's going to look through all of this and he's going to determine if he's going to release more of this. I mean, this was sort of a real surprise.
This is absurd. So this is utterly absurd, and it's absurd on two different levels. Number one, clearly this federal judge not well informed regarding the particulars of the Mueller process and the Mueller report. But I also, this is a point that never quite gets made, is that I'm not sure who what attorneys for the government DOJ is sending in to argue these cases. But here's another example where this judge clearly was unaware in issuing this ruling that that Barr had coordinated with Mueller's team in deciding precisely what should be redacted in that report.
That's a great
so
point.
It wasn't done. It wasn't done unilaterally. Mm-hmm. It was done under mutual agreement. And even when Mueller gave that famous press conference, testified, et cetera, there was no controversy or question that there was agreement over what those redactions should be. Now, some of those redactions are security related, and some of them could be related to ongoing casework, but there was no controversy as it related. This judge has created this controversy.
I wonder what's going on here.
Out of nowhere. But look, he's a federal judge. He's on the court. You have to respect the position. That's part of the messaging, which this Schumer thing as well. We do respect that. I just question how you could get through an entire FOIA case here and come to some conclusion that Barr was acting unilaterally when those redactions were done in complete, yeah, coordination with the Mueller team.
Yeah, a lot of questions there. But listen, speaking about bias here, this next story is in the next few minutes. I want to talk to you. This is a huge story. Chuck Schumer and the war on judges, we'll call it there. And that was an interesting piece. I found a very interesting article that Kimberly Strassel has out from the Wall Street Journal. I thought it was very good, some of the points she made, Michael, on this. But what a story this is. So Chuck Schumer talking about the venue where he was at the Supreme Court and came out and called and talked down both the judges and really threatened them. And of course, then he comes back and says, I'm from Brooklyn. What the hell kind of a comment is that, number one? The fact that you're from Brooklyn gives you...
Right.
License to be great. An idiot. I mean, and bully the Supreme Court.
Trump's from Queens. being from one of the five boroughs is being from one of the five boroughs doesn't inoculate you from responsibility in public.
I love
office.
It. Love it. You think so, buddy, or what? I mean, come on.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's true. So, all right. So let's talk about this column here. I really like what Strassel says here and a couple of things here. Let me read you this here. And these are in her column. She says, Democrats have shifted to threatening the appointees. They have included attacks on individual judges. The hit job in 2018 on Judge Kavanaugh was about as defeating mm-hmm. his nomination or at least cowing him into more liberal rulings. Since his confirmation, now listen to this, Michael. Since his confirmation, Strassel says, Democrats have continued to hold the threat of impeachment over Kavanaugh's head, again, in the hope of intimidating him into taking their side on key cases. Now, I get right to the crux of that, because isn't that really the crux of this whole thing that's going on here, is intimidation, that what Schumer is doing
Absolutely.
To intimidate these judges?
How do you look at it any other way? How do you look at it any other way? I mean, look at the content of his remarks, which, by the way, I'm unclear if they were pre-prepared or if they were spontaneous. I'm a little more forgiving if they were spontaneous, but I don't know. If they, he clearly threatened both of those judges. He clearly referenced them by name and then used "you" in reference to their names. And I don't think there was any confusion about what he attempted to communicate. And then, of course, his spokesperson comes out and says, "Oh no, they weren't talking about Supreme Court judges. He was talking about the Republican Senate." No, that wasn't at all what he was saying. He was talking about holding, you know, them responsible. Of course, that is, you know, if you had gotten up there as a prosecutor with a case before the Supreme Court, or you know, as a plaintiff attorney before the Supreme Court or in any federal court, and threaten a judge like that, that is a crime. It is a violation of numerous federal statutes, including, oh, by the way, obstruction of justice.
Yeah.
Is the very definition of obstruction of justice is threatening judges to come to a conclusion along the lines of what you're saying, and to use intimidation and threats as a means to obtaining that. I thought it was very dangerous to our democracy and our constitutional republic.
George Conway, get a load of this now, the anti-Trumper husband of Kellyanne Conway, which is a whole nother story, people. You can't make this stuff up. He says, if you can believe this, those were threats, pure and simple, he said, of Schumer's comments. And he said that, you know, they can criticize judicial decisions on the merits for their reasoning to their heart's content, but they mustn't use threatening language.
Well, I agree with him on that one. I mean, he just happens to have this president completely wrong.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that he made that statement, and I would say that pretty much mirrors my own views on it.
Yeah, and if I had said to you when we started that you and I would agree with George Conway at the end of this broadcast here, you would have said to me, "You're out of your mind, Malcolm." But here we did, see that? And so I think as you read the tea leaves here, there are a lot of unknowns, but there are some things you need to be doing to protect yourself. Where are we on the market? And what about the global economy and assumptions that we've had for a long time in this country? Where are we at on all of that? Panel discussion coming up next, friends. Stay right there. More Viewpoint in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
It's your news and entertainment network. News blogs, informative podcasts, entertaining videos, or listen to 24/7 talk radio. On our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We the People, AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
What if a new treatment backed by 17,000 scientific articles was proven to extend our lifespan, protect against terrible diseases like cancer, heart disease, and dementia, make us more attractive and thinner, feel calmer and happier, and boost energy levels, memory, and performance? What would you pay for even the smallest dose of this treatment? Well, the good news is you don't have to pay anything, because these are just some of the benefits of a full night of quality sleep. If you're one of the millions of Americans who need better quality sleep, the time to change is now. Until now, most sleep aids haven't worked, but a new, easy-to-swallow sleep gel, invented by the leading nutrition company, Healthy Cell, is designed to support all four stages of human sleep to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deep, and wake up refreshed. It's called REM Sleep. To get a free two-night supply of REM Sleep, visit healthycell.com/sleep. That's healthy, CELL.com/sleep.
Well, it is a story of our times, my friends. And, you know, I know we didn't cover a lot of this in the top stories, and I know it's everybody's top story right now, which is this coronavirus, COVID-19, virus from China. I mean, there are a lot of different ways you can look at it, but it is it's a massive story, massive potential to impact all of our lives in one way, shape, form, or another. I'd like to take a more optimistic look on things as well, as you know me as well, how I look at these things. And I do want to try to give you some comfort ahead here, if possible, and I hope it is, but also ways you might be able to protect yourself and things you can do in your own life. But the reality of the truth as well is always, always important here. So let's talk about that next year. And also the global economy here is another thing. And I think one of the underlying points that we will need to talk about, and if not today, but in the days and weeks ahead, my friends, is how we got here in this, when we talk about globalism. But the dangers of China should not be taken lightly. You know, our political power brokers and industries, how they've sold out really a lot of Americans, which is why we find ourselves in a precarious place right at this moment of time. Well, let's bring on here next, Dennis Santiago is here. He's an American strategist. He focuses on strategic warfare, asymmetric warfare, arms control, global stability. Global stability. Think of those words a moment, huh? Also joining us, Arnetta Notkin is here. Arnetta has a career 30 years, I said to her before the mic went hot, working with the buffoons the nice people on Wall Street, yes. And she has 30 years career in Wall Street working. So, you know, you kind of know the lay of the land at that point. And, of course, Dennis has a strong economic background as well as what he does for a living. So this should be a great segment coming up here next, friends. So the U.S. economy. Get a load of this now, 273,000 jobs in February. And this was a huge amount of hiring before the outbreak. This is, again, the Labor Department is reporting this. Now, Dennis, the economy is going to be tested as this virus spreads and the governments are trying to contain it all clearly. China and Japan now are the world's second and third largest economies. And they're already flirting with recession from the coronavirus shock. And we'll talk more about that a little bit after as we get into more of the global aspect. But looking here at what's happening here in the States here, we can expect, in fact, there are reports now that they're bracing right now for what's going to happen next. But Diane Swank, who is works for Grant Thornton, she's the chief economist there at firm Grant Thornton. She says, the good news is the U.S. has a lot of momentum heading into this crisis, but she expects the economy to slow sharply in the first half of 2020, but avoid a recession. Do you agree with that assessment, or will we be in a recession?
Oh, I agree with that assessment. I think what's happening now is that we're seeing the Chinese at the moment have their economy has slowed down because they have shut the country down. The rest of the world is following in trail. These things are tend to last 3 to 6 months per country. So if you add everything up together, another couple of months in China, and then the beginnings of stuff in Europe, the United States, you put 6 months on that. So the world is going to slow down for a little bit through the summer, I think, and then should pick up again come fall. And then we can worry about the next flu season.
Well, but there are a lot of unknowns with that because the virus will probably get quieter over the summer, as been reported. But again, it depends if we get vaccinations out there across the world. Dennis, don't you think that's a big part of this?
It is a big part of it. Now, on the economic side of it, what you're going to see in the next 3 to 6 months is really there are a lot of slowdowns. You know, airline travel has slowed to nothing, right? I mean, you know, there are actually empty airplanes flying back and forth between here and Europe because there's a European Union law that says if you don't use your airplane slot, you lose it to a competitor. So airlines are actually having to fly empty planes back and forth to keep those slots. The world is beginning to adapt to that. And, you know, so they're starting to change the rules and regulations for this transition period to say, you know, we're going to leave that stuff off. People are talking about sick days or off days. Many companies are now shifting their workforces to work from home for 1 week and alternate with others. So the world is beginning to adapt. It's not as big an adaptation yet as the Chinese have had to do with what they've done, because, you know, there's no smog in China right now because nobody's driving cars. Everybody's staying home.
That's what I see.
You're going to see some of that happening in the rest of the world as well.
Arnett, I want to go right to you now and ask you, in your heart of hearts, in dealing with the market, looking at the conditions, looking how people are adjusting right now, your thoughts between now and, let's call it November, the 2020 election year, how much of a down cycle do you think we're going to have?
Well, the determination will be the faith of the American people and in the president and the economy that he has created. There is no way that it will not go into a recession if the global elitists have their way, because it's win at all cost in 2020.
You're saying that that's their measure of taking Trump down, you're saying, right?
Yeah. That's the new weapon in their arsenal.
Well, that's all they got at this point is a virus from China, huh? They got nothing else.
Correct. But they weaponized it because they've unleashed their pit bulls and their attack dogs and have created mass hysteria and panic. And as with any market, there are always corrections, but this is a forced correction by the elites, including Wall Street. And if the American public can get an iota of the truth of the positive things that are going on, including, as with any airlines, transportations, all the things that are affected by the virus, there are also stocks that are going up at the same time. The stay-home entertainment, the
good point.
Everything. There's investments out there. There always is during a crash.
Well, we've got to look for opportunities, right? Isn't that the key with the market?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you.
The one thing that everyone needs to keep in mind, there's been massive short sellings in the market,
right,
meaning they were predicting ahead of time that the market would go down. Well, all of that stock has to be bought back. So there will be a rebound. Will it be before November 2020? I don't know. I suspect that they will take out all the stops to create a recession and then a credit crisis.
Well, this is what they've been hoping for and praying for. I mean, everybody knows listening here. I mean, you remember Bill Maher coming on his program praying for a recession.
It's being manipulated, Malcolm. Plain and simple, it's being manipulated. But the realities are there are ways that they can take this market down. They already have.
Mm-hmm.
The 30,000 could not be allowed. So now largest point drops in history is down.
That's right.
It affects. There's bottom lines. It affects. It's a normal, natural way of companies adjusting in cycles. They're cyclical, the successes and the growth. But this is not normal. This is not normal, and it's being manipulated.
Yeah, the manipulation is the real question, Dennis, that it's pretty obvious to some of us as to what's really happening here. As Arnetta says, the manipulation of things and the fear factor plays into this big time. But when you see the kind of statements I just made about the companies and the industries that are shutting down, closing down, and making adjustments, what does that say to you?
Well, it says a number of things. Let me get technical on you because for a second here and just bring up 2 points for the people that are really into finance and banking.
All right.
Number one, you see a lot of very large swings going on in the marketplace right now, particularly in the stock market. There's a reason for that. And the reason for that is because over in the bond market side and in the back offices of the financial structure of this country, we have been operating at very thin margins to changes in portfolio structure that for a very long time. We're down to 5/100ths of 1% being the go or no go on massive transitions of portfolios. In the last couple of weeks, we have seen changes in the marketplace that have shifted those incentives. And then we've also seen the Federal Reserve come in and change rates on U.S. Treasuries to the point that a lot of portfolios are having to restructure. And every time that they do this, what you see is the program trades and the institutional trading in the marketplace makes these massive changes in response to very tiny changes in percentages of where the rates are. Mm-hmm. And it causes the rest of the market to vibrate like crazy. And people will react to that. The individual investors react with fear because they see a lot of this stuff going on. The institutional investors basically say, okay, really? I mean, I just crossed over a threshold. I have to readjust my portfolio. So there's part of that going on, and you're seeing it reflect in the rest of the world as far as reporting going on in the mainstream media about what's happening in the markets. But these are really algorithmic changes that are occurring in the system as it adapts to things that are going on. The other thing that you're seeing, which is probably more of concern, is that a lot of these corporations have been living on what they call leverage borrowing. And these are borrows from banks that do not affect their capital structure, but they're basically using the banking system to keep their companies floating at higher levels without having to eat into their core capital. That is the kind of money that can be lost from the economy fairly easily because it's basically the flow and stream of the how the economy is working. It's been going well for the past year. As it slows down, you're going to see some of that leverage lending and leverage borrowing start to contract in response to what's happening on Main Street. And that may in and of itself cause a little bit of stress on the banking system. But, you know, this is, we're still talking fairly low default rates coming out of there. And it's the kind of stuff that if you have 180 days of inventory, 180 days of pad in your designs, which most of these large corporations do, they should be able to see their way pretty far through this coronavirus cycle.
A lot of people tend to overreact in markets like this, Arnetta. That's my sense anyways. Yes. People that have some casual investments or even some more serious investments, they'll make some radical decisions and pull things prematurely. Now, obviously, if you've got the right firm that's representing you, they would stop you, hopefully, from doing that. But let's talk about that panic. From your experience in working on Wall Street and seeing the market and the uncertainty of the market, what should people do right now to protect themselves and their family and lifestyle?
Well, again, they can invest in those companies that are actually showing a positive results and will benefit from this mass hysteria. But the other thing they can do, it's a great time to buy a house. It's a great time to finance a car. If you've got a good job and you're not affected and you're not worried about being laid off, it's a really good time for the public to buy homes because of the interest rates. That's the way you have to think. But inherently, what we used to call the common man and woman, they're the ones that sell at the bottom. They buy at the highs and they sell at the bottoms. And they're also leading indicators in a normal situation where it means the beginning of a turnaround of a market. But if they can just not listen to the rhetoric that's being put out there to cause them concern, mm-hmm. and hang in there, if they've got good stocks with good dividends, that's what you look for. Now's the opportunity. Buy those companies that pay really good dividends.
Yeah.
Another thing, the pharmaceutical companies are actually working together and cooperating together to find a cure for this virus. That's unheard of. And President Trump is planning to, or talking about, pumping in some funds to the hard-hit industries for tax breaks. So the opportunities are there. Just be logical. Think about what's going on.
I like everything you say there. That's great advice, and to look for the silver lining within the industries and the companies, but also the opportunities to refinance things or make a new purchase, that sort of thing. Those are the opportunities, and clearly look at. Dennis, how do we specifically, the little guy typically, and Arnetta just talked about this a little bit here, but gets squashed and things like this. I mean, this is a, you know, this is a mogul's game here. Somebody who typically has the wherewithal and the reach to be able to control markets and industries. It's people who have those kinds of resources. How does the little guy, in your opinion, survive such a storm such as this?
Well, the key to this is don't panic. Okay. I mean, you're going to look, the market goes up and down about 3%. Okay. So it's the Dow is at 30,000. It used to be, you know, like people used back in the old days when the Dow was like 1,000, 1,500, it would go up and down 3%. The market would react and the sky would be falling, but it was only going up and down 3%. The thing that's happening is the market will go up 900, down 1,000, up 800, down 500. But if you really look at where the line is, it's kind of still kind of staying about there. These are institutions that are making massive portfolio changes around you. And this is not the little guy's game. All right. You can't ride that roller coaster because, among other things, these institutions have the advantage that their computers are right next door to the market computers in a building. Okay. And they talk over a wire that has a 200 millisecond advantage over everybody else in the country, even over the funds. So there is there are structural advantages that the little guy just can't touch. So what you really have to do is pay attention to your fundamentals. If your fundamentals are good, ride the waves because you know you're going to come out on the other side. And that's about the best advice that you can give to somebody right now.
Well, let me take a moment. I want to tell you about this very interesting article up on the platform and talk to you a little bit more about what we're doing here back at America Out Loud. And as we take on to the next cycle here, I want to talk to Arnetta and Dennis more about COVID-19 and the fact that this is America's wake-up call. Before we get there here, let me take just a moment to remind everybody all of the amazing, talented columnists and show hosts, podcast, talk radio, bloggers. It's all back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Take a look back there. Share the information. Share the wealth of knowledge and information that is back there. We're on a mission here at America Out Loud, and it is to right the wrongs, and it is to put justice back where injustice is. And you know, and if we're gonna do this, people, and really. Accomplish what we want to accomplish. And right at the top of America Out Loud, it says here, we have to take on the challenges of our generation so that we can preserve future generations. Now, is there a more noble cause than that, people? Really? Think about it, you know? So as we continue back with the conversation here about this COVID-19 business, Dennis has an outstanding, and I do mean outstanding, message article. There's a great column on the platform. Today, as you hear this on Sunday, on Viewpoint this Sunday, COVID-19 is America's wake-up call. It is an absolute must-read. You'll want to read it twice because there's so many great points in here. Dennis, you talk at the top here about the sign of the time. But back with the Spanish flu in 1918. Now, listen to this. I got thinking a lot about this because you mentioned that in your article as well. That was the last great pandemic that struck the earth. And this was about 100 years ago. Think about it, 1918, people, you know. And we're talking about some real numbers here between 20 and 50 million of us. You talk about some numbers. I mean, wow. And, you know, back then, you didn't have the travel. You didn't get into those aluminum tubes and fly, you know, 500-600 miles an hour around the globe. That wasn't there back then. But it still it was a massive hit to the planet. And when you look at this virus right now and you see the way travel is, the way we are a connected society, why is that so different right now? But we didn't have that kind of travel back in 1918, and they still lost that amount of people. How do you relate to those two?
You know, the Spanish flu pandemic actually took 2 years to work its way through.
Yeah, massive.
1918 to 1920. Okay, and because that was kind of the travel speed that you had back then. People traveled by boat and people traveled by train, and so things moved slower. What's happening with COVID-19 is now we travel by airliner, and so you can get stuff into different parts of the world a lot faster. So the cycle of patient zeros getting into different parts of the world actually happened in a matter of probably a month and a half. really, as opposed to.
So it's going to happen sooner now, you're saying.
Yeah, yeah, it's going to happen faster, and all of the cycles will happen essentially simultaneously in different parts of the world. What's different about that is where the response for the Spanish flu could really be tackled over time, you know, at telegraph speed, really. What's happening now is because the patient zeros have arrived in different parts of the world almost simultaneously, the whole world has to build up into kind of an orchestral crescendo simultaneously and tackle it everywhere at once. That's a different kind of challenge for the human race than we had 100 years ago. On the whole, so far, we seem to be doing a decent job of understanding what we have to do. Whether or not we'll get overwhelmed by the sheer magnitude,
that's
of it
the question. Yeah. Well, medical science is far more superior today than it was back 100 years ago, clearly. And that's a big factor as well, in that we probably won't see those kinds of numbers. But, you know, because really, Dennis, the Spanish flu was really, it was also an upper respiratory problem like this is here. And again, the with this flu, COVID-19, if you've got problems, if you're elderly or you've got issues, other health-related issues, this, as you hear them talking about that now, you've got to be real super careful. You got to be careful with your parents and grandparents if they're in that kind of a position. You know, I got thinking, Arnetta, about when you look back at the Spanish flu and the amount of people that lost their lives. And, you know, and this was right after the end of World War I. And you think about the carnage and the deaths there. And I got thinking a little bit about, I tend to do that these days, life and the big picture of life, Arnetta. And it's interesting and how blessed we all are when you think about the families and the tracks and families that were obliterated back then. When you think about something just as that one pandemic and the world wars that happened, how different it would have been with the amount of people that died that weren't able to carry on those family legacies. And I got thinking about that in these last few days in a very interesting way, and thinking how different this time is. And the fact that we're even all here, that you and I are here right now, that our families weren't caught up in either a world war or a Spanish flu or something else. Do you see where my mind went on that? Kind of an interesting look at the time of things, though, isn't it? You know,
it is. It is, Malcolm. And actually, you just brought to mind something that is very stark to me. And that is the open border policy in these countries that are being hit. And then President Trump trying again to close the borders and protect this country. So we're blessed to be in this country with the sanitation, with the action of what President Trump has done to close the border, shut down travel. But yes, I also thought about what you talked about, because there's just my son and I have been hammering him about being careful about this virus. He Airbnbs his apartment and wiping it down. The virus lives, I think, normally for 9 days on metal, glass, and plastics. You know, just with common sense and sanitation, we can preserve our generations moving forward and not allow this to really affect and lose massive numbers in our families and our generation.
Yeah. Well, I want to encourage everybody to read COVID-19 is America's wake-up call. And there are a lot of reasons why that is. It gets into more of the sign of the times, but also the globalization of our country and the dangers of that and where we find ourselves right now. We're going to have to readjust some things here in this nation. I want to suggest to you, we're going to have to readjust our belt a little bit, you see, and make sure our britches and our pants stay on securely here. And we're going to have to focus ahead in this nation and get back to, if we're going to keep America great, what does that really mean? And how do we position ourselves in this global economy and with the times and travel and everything else? I think these are moments we can clearly say that humankind is being tested right this very moment. And this is maybe our days when your faith comes into play And maybe you start questioning the bigger picture of things. I mean, I do that regularly because it's a way of stepping back and looking at things. But anyways, count your blessings is my message today to you. Protect yourself, your families, basic precautionary things. Always do well. Stay close with us here at America Out Loud. Our mission and platform and the brilliance and the people on the platform, it cannot be missed by anyone. We're on a mission, and certainly it is we the people striking back at the heart of what's important to all of us. Big thank you to Dennis Santiago, Arnetta Notkin, and what a great program here with Michael Johns early on in the program here. Friends, thank you again here, and remember, it's time to get involved and get loud.